Andrew Sterling has always dreamed of leaving the big city and escaping to a secluded island. No stress, no hassles, no problems. That is, until he met another man trying to escape.
You're in here.
Andrew meets Amos.
I have a shotgun. You have a frying pan.
And in one wild night...
I want $1 million! And a helicopter!
Put your weapon down. Let your hostage go.
Two guys from two different worlds.
Maybe you've heard of the Pulitzer Prize.
You won that?
I did.
How much you win?
In one fell swoop... became partners in crime.
We're gangsters.
Freeze!
We're outlaws.
Sounded like they were getting pretty chummy to me.
Two people who came to an island for one reason.
Get it!
To escape.
Sit!
Not you.
Nicolas Cage.
Contributing to the delinquency of a minor.
What do you have to say about that? She looked 18.
Samuel L. Jackson. Amos and Andrew. A comedy about two mismatched men trying to escape from each other.
Hello and welcome to The Complete Works, an in-depth look into the career and filmography of Nicolas Cage. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me on this journey into the depths of true cagedom is my friend, co-host, and fellow cageaholic,
Mike Jacuccio.
How you doing today, Mike?
Good, good. I think today will be an interesting and quick discussion.
You can say interesting discussion about almost anything we discuss, Mike, because we can make anything interesting.
Let's go with that one. I like that. That sounds good.
As for quick, I could agree with you there. This is not that much to talk about here. It won't be that interesting. Today we move into 1993, in which Nicolas Cage took part in a racially charged comedy that paired him up with Samuel L. Jackson. The film was Amos and Andrew, a title which invokes the famously racist radio and television show from the 1950s, Amos and Andy.
Hey, how about that?
So the film was written and directed by E. Max Fry, and is the only film that Fry's ever directed, but he is a prolific writer. He's known for his work on Jonathan Demme's Something Wild, the HBO miniseries Band of Brothers, and most recently he was an Oscar nominee for Bennett Miller's Foxcatcher with Channing Tatum and Steve Carell.
Wow. How far he's come.
Yeah, Amos and Andrew is like a blip on his radar. Like he's been part of like some high profile stuff, but like, the one thing he's directed was Amos and Andrew.
Was this one.
Yeah. Amos and Andrew, I think, is a really odd movie. It's ostensibly a comedy dealing with incredibly heavy subject matter. And I did not think it was able to pull it off particularly well.
No, not that. It starts off uncomfortable, but then kind of becomes aware. Like, it ups the, like, silliness of what's going on. And, like, okay, I get what you're poking fun at all the stuff that's happening. And then it kind of shifts back to make a point, and the point is really weird and doesn't make sense. I don't think it makes a point,
right?
But it tries to,
yeah,
and just falls back to uncomfortableness.
Yeah, exactly. I think like the subject matter of this movie actually seems more relevant today in 2016 than it did back when this movie would have come out in 1993.
We'll have to double check, but this might be around the Rodney King trial
and all that stuff.
I mean, it's kind of stuff that's always in the public consciousness anyway.
Right. Right. But just considering the news over the last, like, 2 years, like, this feels like...
Oh, yeah. That's definitely one of my notes I took down. Accurate representation of police work today.
Boom.
That's my hot take.
But the movie kind of flips back and forth between treating the issue of racism seriously and treating it like a joke.
Yeah.
And I found myself pretty uncomfortable for most of its runtime. The movie did not do great business when it was first released. On a budget of $17 million, it made around $9 million. It did not get good reviews either, as it currently sits at a 21% of Rotten Tomatoes. Amos and Andrew is essentially forgotten, especially kind of overshadowed by the huge career turns that Nicolas Cage and Samuel L. Jackson would both experience shortly after this movie came out. Pulp Fiction came out a year later, for example. So Samuel L. Jackson blew up 1 year after this movie came out. Right. And Nicolas Cage would win an Oscar for Leaving Las Vegas 2 years later. His career would go off, like, he would be a superstar in the late 90s. And so this is a weird movie because it stars, like, two guys who are huge stars, who are still today household names. And at this point in time, Nicolas Cage was pretty well known. Samuel Jackson, not as much. But this kind of headlines both of them right before their careers really took off.
Yeah. Yeah, they're featured in this really odd, uncomfortable comedy just before getting really big. So I guess it's good that this movie happened first. I feel like if they had made this kind of movie after they became huge stars, they might not have lasted.
I don't know about that. But I mean, like if this movie had come out in like 1996, right after the, you know, Nicolas Cage won an Oscar and Samuel Jackson became more well known, it probably would have made much more than its budget. As opposed to...
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
As opposed to making half of it.
is that not the goal, Mike? The goal is to make money?
That's... Theoretically, that is the plan.
Oh, all right. Just checking.
The film stars Nicolas Cage as Amos Odell, a career criminal who unexpectedly befriends Andrew Sterling, played by Samuel L. Jackson. The rest of the cast includes Dabney Coleman, a phenomenal character actor from Boardwalk Empire, Brad Dourif from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and as the voice of Chucky from Child's Play. He plays Officer Daniel Donnie Donaldson. If you wanted to match the voice, it's probably not the same voice.
Got it.
Michael Lerner from Barton Fink, Margaret Collin from Gossip Girl and Emax Fry's own Something Wild, Bob Balaban from Moonrise Kingdom and Seinfeld, and Giancarlo Esposito from Breaking Bad.
Yeah, I was wondering if that was him from his first scene, which is very quick.
Right.
Then he becomes more prominent towards the end.
Right, and he's using a much different voice than he uses in Breaking Bad as well. He has like a more like high-pitched lilt to his character than he does in Breaking Bad, which is very like subdued.
And way more tennis.
Yeah. And the IMDb plot synopsis, and this is a user-submitted plot synopsis.
So it's going to be good.
It's actually, you know, it's weird because these IMDb plot synopsises, for like they'll have them for the bigger movies, but they're going to be like one or two sentences. They're not going to tell you anything.
Right.
But then for these like obscure, really small movies, there's always one user submitted plot synopsis that is like a paragraph long. And as a journalist, I'm obliged to read them. So
we use that term loosely.
Yeah.
obliged, I mean.
Right. Not journalist, obviously. So the IMDb plot synopsis submitted by the user reads, when Andrew Sterling, a successful black urbanite writer, buys a vacation home on a resort in New England, the police mistake him for a burglar. After surrounding his home with armed men, Chief Tolliver realizes his mistake and, to avoid the bad publicity, offers a thief in his jail, Amos Odell, a deal. Amos is to pretend to take Andrew prisoner and hold him for ransom but let him go and escape. Amos and Andrew suddenly realize the chief's problems are all gone if the two of them both die in a gun battle. The worst partnership in film history then tries to get away from the local police.
Wow, some editorializing in there.
Yeah. I feel like this is not a totally unbiased film synopsis. It's very weird. You're reading it, and this has to be like from like some kind of super fan or something. Who else would take the time?
Right.
To write out a paragraph long synopsis for Amos and Andrew. And then I just keep reading it as it goes on. And then suddenly it's like, you know, it gets like less and less acclaim for the movie as it goes on. It's like Amos and Andrew, and like the grammar starts to go away. And suddenly it's just the worst partnership in film history. And you're like, whoa.
Yeah, it follows a similar arc to this film where it's like, okay, maybe a little bit. And then it falls apart and gets weird.
Yeah, so I guess, Mike, give me your overall thoughts on Amos and Andrew.
Well, if my last statement wasn't an indication. It starts off in a weird, uncomfortable thing. I don't know if it's a product of it being 2016, but, like, racist jokes aren't okay. Kind of weird. And then it kind of arcs into... pokes fun at the situation, the insanity of the police department, and like all these ridiculous things that are going on, and kind of becomes a little self-aware at what, you know, joining Nicolas Cage and Samuel Jackson. I think they actually have a really funny chemistry together.
Okay.
So those scenes are, even though they kind of are awkward and uncomfortable, they are still funny. But then it tries to make a point somewhere about racism and everyone's at fault, I think, is what the movie is trying to say, but I don't think that is a thing that is right or whatever. I don't know. And it just kind of falls apart and then just sort of ends. So,
yeah. Yeah, it's weird. It's like for the first like 2/3 of this movie's runtime, it's actually trying to make kind of a statement about racism. And then in the last third, it kind of just becomes like a buddy comedy with Nick Cage and Samuel L. Jackson, completely kind of negating the point that it was making earlier. And even then, like the point it was trying to make like felt very muddled and it didn't like do that much for me. It felt like the movie was trying to handle something very delicate and not doing it well at all, kind of smashing whatever delicacy it had against the window.
Yeah, and I'm not even sure if it even tried to make a point, which is like the is the issue, I think.
Yeah, like when you have this kind of subject matter, like this is a movie that takes on like police profiling and police brutality.
Yeah.
And racial profiling and all this kind of stuff, and it's something that I think you could you could make a very good dark comedy out of this kind of stuff. Yeah. You know, there's definitely like absurdity and stuff to be had there that could be like pointed out, and like there's jokes to be made. This movie does not do them well.
Yeah, no, it doesn't at all. Although the only good moment, like it has moments. There is one where, you know, the white couple that sees Samuel Jackson through the window, and they are interviewed, and they, you know, when you see a black man on this island with the stereo in his hand, you kind of know what he's doing. And, you know, that whole, like you said, racial profiling and all that. And then we cut to them back in their home, like, doing coke and smoking weed.
Yes.
Like, yes, that was the perfect, like, this upper-class white, he's thinking that they're lawyers, or he's a lawyer, at
right.
least.
Right, he was a lawyer.
He was a lawyer. You know, they, well, we're so haughty and better than this black man. Meanwhile, they're the ones breaking the law. Like, it could do more like that, more things like that. But that's kind of the only one that
I think. Yeah. I mean, what did you think of Samuel Jackson in this movie?
He's a baller, of course.
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously Samuel Jackson's always usually really good. But I thought this performance was like different than a lot of his other stuff. It's not like the shouty Samuel Jackson that you would get in later his career. Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, there's hints of it. And the note I made, where is it? I want him to drop history lessons on me all day. Because at the very end, as they're getting in the car to drive away, he's like, look, I don't have time to give you a history lesson. He does the Samuel Jackson scream yell thing. It was awesome. But throughout the rest of the movie, he is more subdued than we see him. And I think that it's the post-Pulp Fiction Samuel Jackson that we all know and love. And that's what he is in Pulp Fiction. So I don't know.
Right.
But he does a good job. He's awesome.
Yeah. And then, like... one of the other things about this movie, like, it's trying to take on racism in a way that I think kind of makes the movie racist in itself. Like,
oh,
this,
yeah.
Like, there are scenes of people in blackface.
Yeah.
Oh, and there's a lot of it. Like,
yeah, that's true. I didn't think – yeah, I didn't even put that together.
Like, and there's a lot of blackface and, like – if you're making fun of the person who is in blackface, I could see that being funny. But also, like, I didn't feel like the movie was doing that.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah. Because, I mean, the blackface is the cop who puts put blackface on, but not to pretend to be black. But, yeah. Because he says, oh, it's a night ops. Like, you know, the stupid. Right. And that was what made me think of the you know, the representation of police is that it's cops pretending, playing army man. Like, they think they're some high elite squad and they're just bumping idiots in this. But, and that's another indication of that. But yeah, you're right. The blackface stuff is, it feels really odd and out of place in a movie that seems to be attempting to tackle racism. But the issue is if you fail at that, you end up being racist.
Right. Exactly. That's the problem.
Yeah.
But there's other stuff. There's one really interesting cut that I thought was there's a cut where like Samuel Jackson goes in to shake the dog's hand,
yeah,
and then it cuts, and then it's somebody shaking somebody else's hand,
yeah,
like it's a match cut. And it's like it was this weird like stylistic choice,
right?
In a movie that doesn't have like any other stylistic choices.
Yeah, I don't. That's a good point. I think it speaks volumes that we don't even remember who's shaking hands in that cut.
True.
Because that should be very important, you know, who's the dog in that, like, who's the one, to say, like, you know, in that equivalent. in the cut, who would be the dog in that scene? I don't remember. Right. I don't even know. But I mean, let's be very on the nose with the all white German Shepherd named Rommel.
Right.
Which I think is a great, like, a great device they use and have. But that's kind of, it's just there. They don't really do a whole lot with it. It's just funny to me.
True. Yep. All right. I did want to bring this up. Did you stick around through the credits?
That's my note. The only reason to watch this movie.
This movie has a rap.
It has an original Sir Mix-a-Lot song.
Yes. Sir Mix-a-Lot did a song called Suburban Nightmare.
Yeah.
Just recounting the plot of this movie.
It's the whole movie. It's hilarious.
Over the credits. And it's way more worth it than the actual movie is, I think. It's like so good. It's so good. I miss the era. Like, there was a time in like the mid-90s where like if a studio blockbuster was coming out, like there was a rap attached to it at the end credits.
You could guarantee Will Smith had a song.
Yeah. If Will Smith was starring in a movie, there'd be a rap. And it was great. There was a great time. It's a great period in our history. And I wish we could go back to that. I wish. And actually, it's weird that we watch this now. I don't know if you saw Money Monster this past weekend.
I haven't seen it. I've seen trailers for it.
Okay. I've not seen the movie yet either, but I've heard pretty good things. I'd like to see it if I can. But from what I've heard, there's a rap at the end of Money Monster.
No way.
There is. There's an actual thing.
That's amazing.
Which is my main reason for wanting to see Money Monster.
Just for the rap at the end.
Just for the rap at the end. Like, I'm guaranteed to, like, add half a star to something.
Just for the rap.
Like, I remember I watched Monster Squad, which is a movie that I did not think was good, like, at all.
Okay.
I watched it probably about a year ago, maybe. Are you familiar with Monster Squad?
I've heard of it. I can't put it together.
It's a movie from the 80s. It's kind of like The Goonies, but it has, like, kids and, like, a bunch of monsters that are attacking them.
Okay, sure.
And it's actually co-written by Shane Black, who is awesome, but I was not a fan of Monster Squad. But it ends with a rap that goes, "Yo, we're the Monster Squad. That's it." I was going to rate the movie like 2 stars on Netflix. I ended up rating it 3 stars
just for the rap.
Just for the rap, that bumped it up.
That's impressive. Yeah, my note is this is only worth watching for the Sir Mix-a-Lot song.
Yeah, so definitely, I'll probably play the Sir Mix-a-Lot song out as this podcast is over. Oh. But it is well worth it. And obviously, Sir Mix-a-Lot wasn't the best, so.
It just lends to the, like, how early 90s.
Yeah,
and that was. Like, just, it's like the B-list of early 90s, I guess.
It's like, unsuccessful movie from 1993, Sir Mix-a-Lot song. Like,
yeah.
It's like. That's the thing.
It pulls it all together.
Yeah. So that was like the highest praise I can give this movie is that it has a great rap at the end by Sir Mix-a-Lot. otherwise, I mean, what do you think of Nicolas Cage in this movie? Let's talk about Cage.
He delivers a good performance. It's very odd, though.
Yeah.
That's kind of the rest of the movie is.
He plays a pretty solid, like, slimy character in this movie. I feel like he was kind of sleepwalking through the role a little bit for a lot of the movie. And it's kind of like shades of characters that we've seen him play before.
Yes.
Too, like in Zandali or Vampire's Kiss. Like, I feel like it's kind of shades of similar characters like that.
Yeah, he comes off very sleazy throughout the whole thing, which I guess is the point.
Right. One of my big notes is that he's also like a pedophile, or like not a pedophile, but like.
Oh, the pizza girl?
Well, yeah. That, but also earlier in the movie, there's like a line where Cage is talking to Dabney Coleman, and Coleman's like, "Oh, you're in. Why? Like, do you know why you're here?" And Cage's like, "Well, she looked 18."
Oh yeah, I totally missed that too.
So implying that he's in jail for statutory rape. So then, you know, great start to getting us to like this character, and
there's no better character trait for someone in a comedy.
than a statutory rapist. It's like the protagonist in Transformers 4, who's constantly ogling Mark Wahlberg's daughter.
Hey man, Romeo and Juliet laws, though.
But in any case, I didn't even see Transformers 4. I just know that from
yeah, it's super creepy
from cultural osmosis. But anyway, later on in the movie, Cage and Samuel Jackson's character Andrew are hiding out in the neighbor's house, and they order a pizza. Because they want to use the pizza delivery truck as like their getaway.
Yeah.
And like the girl comes in and she has the pizza, and you just, there's this like lengthy scene of Cage just hitting on the girl.
Yeah, it's really creepy, and like they don't really establish that she's 18 ever.
She definitely says she's like 17. I'm pretty sure she says she's 17.
Probably. There were a lot of moments where I kind of zoned out on this movie.
She says she's 17 and she has a boyfriend, and Cage is like, oh, well, you know. And
do you love him? I heard that part.
Do you love him? Weird. And she's like, no, not really. And she's like totally falling for Cage, like within seconds.
Yeah, with his shotgun.
Yeah. and then she writes her phone number on his hand and she says, call me.
Yeah. It's super creepy. I did really like the, I guess that's a strong way to put that. I thought it was kind of clever or funny, at least, to show just how like incompetent and stupid Cage's character is. So right before the credits end, or credits roll, he like puts on his sunglasses and he's like, Canada, here I come. And he pulls out on the highway he's going 95 south.
Yeah, the opposite direction.
Yeah.
Which is pretty good. And yeah, Cage's like big motivation in this movie is he just wants to get to Canada.
Just wants to get to Canada.
Yeah. Don't we all?
Yeah. Probably come November, yes. Another hot take. You come to this podcast.
You were just on it today with your controversial comments. Honestly, I don't know what else to say about this movie. I think
And I felt like it had there was another moment where it kind of tried to tap into what's going on, you know, tackling racism, where it starts off when Nicolas Cage and Samuel L. Jackson flee the house for the first time. They're handcuffed together, which clearly echoes The Defiant Ones with Sidney Poitier. But then it turns into like this dumb buddy comedy.
Right. It's actually interesting you say that, because on the Wikipedia page, it says the premise also appears to be a riff on The Defiant Ones.
Yeah, but it's a cheap version of that.
Right.
It's like, oh, we're going to make it the cool 90s comedy way. but then you don't.
Right. So you're saying just watch The Defiant Ones.
Watch The Defiant Ones. A much better version.
Yeah, so there you go. Otherwise, I mean, what about the supporting cast? What did you think of the cast surrounding Cage and Jackson?
They do a good job of just being, like, the bumbly, ignorant white people.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I mean, I love Michael Lerner, he plays the male neighbor, the lawyer. And he's amazing in Barton Fink. Have you seen Barton Fink?
I have not, actually. Dude.
He is amazing in Barton Fink. He's fantastic. And he's kind of playing a similar character here, kind of like all flustered and all that kind of stuff. But I think, you know, he makes a very unlikable character in this movie, as does his wife. I actually really enjoyed Bob Balaban as the therapist, Dr. Fink.
Yes.
Who just spends like the entire movie basically therapizing himself over the phone.
Into the answering machine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was great. I did kind of like that. The kind of like escalation of just the miscommunications and like all comedy of errors type stuff that's going on
that
escalates all the way out throughout the film, but kind of to no point. Like it they burn the house down.
Yep.
It's just kind of because, and like, but it doesn't prove anything. Like it doesn't go anywhere with it. And
I don't know. Yeah. Nobody learns from their actions.
Exactly. In this movie. Needs to happen in a movie about racism.
I mean, doesn't. Like theoretically, yeah, <It'd> kind of nice. But yeah, I also kind of enjoyed Giancarlo Esposito as the Reverend Fenton Brunch, which is his character's name,
right?
Who's like kind of just stirring everybody into a frenzy about this whole ordeal.
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, that's especially in the early 90s, that could be an allegory for Al Sharpton.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think that's what he was. I think I read that somewhere that he was channeling Al Sharpton.
Yeah, so it's doing, attempting to do these things, and then, like we've said, just kind of...
Yeah, flux. It has, like, surface-level ideas with no execution to them, which is unfortunate. But, I don't know, do you have anything else you want to say about the movie, Mike?
If you can, just find the Sir Mix-a-Lot song on YouTube.
Right, it's called Suburban Nightmare. I'll play some of it as this podcast ends. But before we get into that, we should do some Netflix reviews.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I feel like you forgot that this category exists, but then you got really excited that it is. So
I'm so excited. I'm always excited for these.
All right. So we got some Netflix reviews for Amos and Andrew, some funny ones. Here's a 3-star review of Amos and Andrew from Netflix. This is a cute story. with two good actors in the main parts.
That's it?
Well, there's a little more, but it's not as funny. I just thought it was funny that he said, this is a cute story. All right, 5-star review. Since I love Nicolas Cage and Samuel L. Jackson, it didn't take much for me to love this movie.
Wow.
I'm usually not a big fan of comedy because they are so predictable. This was so funny, even if it's sometimes varied on the goofy. I don't know what varied means.
That's not what that word means.
The great acting and the storyline made it great entertainment.
Sure.
Here's a 3-star review. Remember when Nicolas Cage actually looked like he was having fun shooting a movie? Amos and Andrew's Cage at a young age still enjoying his craft. That isn't to say he is a poor actor or that his current movies are bad. Rather, he has lost that joy that permeates through him from his younger days.
Wow. That guy's got a hot take.
This movie is a bit thin and never comes close to using its full comedic potential, but still makes for a good time waster. Which I like that his criteria is, well, it wasted my time, but it did it in a good way. So
yeah, that's perfect.
Here's a 4-star review. The first time I saw this film was by accident. I didn't read the synopsis. During the film, I thought it was made by the Coen brothers.
What? Okay.
After it was over, I did a search to find out it wasn't. Yes, seriously that good. Reminded me of Raising Arizona and Fargo.
That's a lie.
That is bold.
There's no way.
Here's a 5-star review of Amos and Andrew. So funny. The domino effect was wonderful. It even managed to put a smile on my normally miserable face? Question mark?
Is there really a question
There's mark? A question mark. Highly recommend this film to other miserable so-and-sos out there.
Oh, man. Dr. Fink, is that you?
Boom. Bob Balaban reference. Here's a 3-star review. This movie is okay if you're over 25, then you may have memories of this movie, which would make it a classic. For everyone else, it's a waste of time.
I think if the term waste of time or time waster comes up in two different movies.
Well, for this one, this guy's saying if you're under 25, it's a waste of time. For anyone over 25, you'll probably see it as an unmitigated classic, and there's no in between.
Oh my God. That's a good, I don't understand people.
Here's a 1-star review on Amos and Andrew. It didn't make much sense, so I did not watch the whole movie. This weekend's movies were all terrible. Wish I had not ordered them.
Oh man, that poor guy.
Yeah. So, I mean, not only did he not like Amos and Andrews, but whatever movie he didn't like, whatever movie he also got, he also didn't like, and instead take it out on the Amos and Andrew review page. And finally, here's a 5-star review, which you might recognize. Nicolas Cage is doing what he does best, and that's making great movies. It's the same guy from the Honeymoon in Vegas review.
Oh my God.
The same review. I have added it to my DVD collection.
That's amazing.
It's the exact same review from Honeymoon in Vegas.
I like to think that that's just Nicolas Cage set up some bot. Comment that on all of his.
I am really hoping that every Netflix review from here on out, I can find one of these. because it makes me laugh.
That's
he's
hilarious.
Just doing what he does best, and that's making great movies.
I was going to say, to anyone listening, if you go and check and there's a Nicolas Cage movie that doesn't have that review, put it on there so that when we get to it, it's there.
There we go. That's perfect. So, once again, Nicolas Cage is doing what he does best. And that's making great movies. I have added it to my DVD collection.
There you go.
So,
help us continue the bit.
We're nothing if not doing a bit.
Yeah. Let's be real.
Yeah. All right. Mike, where can we find you online this week?
Find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, my friends and I stream our games at twitch.tv/geonerd79.
And you can follow me at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog, as well as our Filmbook Podcast Twitter account at Filmbook Podcast. You can find my other podcasts at filmbook.com, including my Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and Gotham podcast. And you can find our other podcast, Filmbookcast, there as well. Thank you for listening to The Complete Works. I'm Mike Smith, and that's Mike's Pre-Show. If you're listening to this review of your podcast, if you are listening to this review of your podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email because we produce so many different ones, hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Join us in 2 weeks where we'll be discussing Nicolas Cage in Christopher Coppola's 1993 film Deadfall, which currently boasts a hearty 0% on Rotten Tomatoes.
I hope we can even find it.
It's it was available on Netflix DVD, actually.
Okay.
So I think you should be able to find it if I can get it there through whatever means you so choose.
Yes.
Check out this week's film bookcast where we're going to be discussing The Nice Guys.
I'm super excited for that movie.
Yeah. Me too. I honestly can't wait. Like, this is kind of like Christmas for me. Like, there's a new Shane Black movie coming out, which is fitting because Shane Black puts Christmas in all of his movies.
That's a good point.
All right. Thank you so much for listening, guys. We are out.
You can check my blackness back if I'm rough as a cactus. Now I gotta change what I practice. So I went to the suburbs and bought me a big house, and now they wanna run a brother out. I'm a well-educated young maker of revenue, rolling in a big black BMW. So I'm supposed to fit because I'm straight legit, but the police still wanna trip. They accuse me of robbing myself. Never seen a brother with wealth. Hell, I thought I was big and now I'm trapped in a house cause the cops got my crib staked out. The police chief is running for commissioner. But if I get out of this, chief, I'm getting ya. Chief needs a cover-up plan, cause he heard I'm famous. Call a crazy white boy, name was Amos. I thought Amos was a burglar, but when he saw me, he said, I never heard of ya. He couldn't tell north from south, but Amos was my only way out of this suburban nightmare.